Hello and welcome to Messiah's Upper Room Podcast. Each week, you'll join Messiah's Upper Room Bible Study class led by Pastor Jim Oddy. This week, we continue our series over reconciliation. Enjoy.
Overall aim or the goal of it is. So if you follow along with me again, we'll look at Matthew 18, 15 to 20, and then we'll kind of go through the rest of the outline. If your brother or sister sins against you, should be against you, go and point out their fault just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you've won them over. But if they do not listen, take one or two others along so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. And if they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church. And if they refuse to listen even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. So just out of curiosity, I don't know, how many pagans and tax collectors do you know, and how are you treating them? Depends on the time of the year, I suppose. It does, right. Yeah, so a lot of people, when they look at that verse, they think, well, then that means you should shun them. That means that you should revile them. That means that you should treat them in a shoddy way because, after all, they're pagan, and after all, they're somebody that would be, we would probably feel opposed to in some way. But something you want to think about, how did Jesus treat pagans and how did Jesus treat tax collectors? He loved them, true, he loved them, right. But how did that love show up in his active treatment of them?
He discipled them.
He didn't avoid them. Now, it doesn't mean that he just said, oh, hey, do whatever you want. It wasn't that. But he saw in them great value, and he treated them that way as people who would be worthy of the kingdom that he was bringing to the world. And see, I think sometimes we look at that verse and we think, oh, that means that, gosh, they won't even listen to Christians. They won't even listen to the church. So we should just end with them, okay? And unfortunately, in the history of the Christian church, people have been treated that way. And I think to some degree, it was a failure to read the rest of the verse, right? Or allowing our own personal feelings about somebody too much to influence how we treat somebody. So anyway, that I felt like I wanted to mention that, even though we'll talk about it at the end too. Yeah, Leah.
No, I'm just resting my arm. Sorry.
This is like an auction. Any movement you make, I'm assuming that you want to up the ante, and I will call on you to do that. So. Okay, good. Let that be a good lesson for all of us here. All right. So anyway, so the template, I've tried to illustrate a little bit here on the board, or the facsimile of what I had illustrated on the board, is that the idea of it is that person A and person B, I see a need already to do a little correction here. So we'll do it like this. See, this is a little bit like the telephone game. You know the telephone game? The person originates something, and then the next person sort of adjusts it a little bit. Well, that's kind of what's happened here. So that's all we have to do, just like that, okay? All right. So person A has done something that brought pain to person B. Now, does that mean that person A realizes that he or she did that to person B? Is it possible that you could hurt someone's feelings, you could offend somebody, you could step on their toes, you could have a misunderstanding, you could do all those things and have no clue that you did? Yes, it is very often the case that is. So the question is, what is person B supposed to do with that? If the person B is grossly offended, or if the person B is deeply hurt, or if person B is maybe abused in some way, there's a serious thing here, or maybe it's a little annoyance, a slight irritation, right? This person still feels it. The question is, and Jesus is kind of laying that template out for us, is what are you supposed to do with it? Are you supposed to just say, oh, well, that's the way the person is? Are you supposed to forgive and forget? Are you supposed to figure out some sneaky way to get even with the person? Oh, that one, yeah, we like that one, okay? All right, and so what does Jesus say? If your brother does what? Sins against you, do what? Go to him. There's an it between you, right? That we have an it. And so you're supposed to go to him, all right? Now, let's think about it from that perspective. What often gets in the way of the person feeling confident that they can go to person A and do that?
Pride.
Pride?
Or fear.
Fear. Okay, you're talking about kind of emotional things. That person could be anxious about doing that, right? That could be, yeah. Yeah.
I think B might think they're right.
Do what?
They may think they're right and the other one's wrong.
This person thinks they're right and this person's wrong?
Yeah.
Okay. And so but how would that cause this person to not want to go to that person?
Well, then he thinks A should come to me.
Oh, yes, A should come to me because A's the one that did it. Right. But what if A does not know that what he or she did was the offensive thing, which again is often the problem. See, if I know that it is, well, okay, then probably, and again, we're talking in a Christian setting, right, that the conscience self-awareness, good thing, right? But, you know, some people are kind of obtuse, maybe we would say clueless, right? And so there may not be that level of awareness. Then that's kind of what, but good point, all right? What else? Yeah, Peggy?
What about past experience with that person?
Past experience with that person.
Being experienced with A.
So that could get in the way. Because that person might say, well, I remember the last time I went and talked to that person about something that that person did, and boy, that blew up in my face, and I'm never going to do that ever again, okay? It could also be, and this often happens, this person represents somebody. And what happens is this person says, well, I never have gone to that person before, but I know his type. And they say, well, because I experienced the trauma of that one at one time in my life, and oh, that was terrible, then I'm never going to do it again with someone in authority, or with someone who's my boss, or someone who's my pastor, or someone who is smarter than me, or you know, whatever is the reason that the person gives. And so what happens is there's a block. There's a blockage there. The blockage is not in the hurt that the person feels. But think of this as a wall, okay? The wall goes up, and when it does, where does all of that hurt go? Because see, that's what the person is carrying inside, is that hurt. So where does it go? It almost has to have an outlet. And the normal outlet is that people take advantage of us to do what? Seek out somebody else. And Jesus is saying, you can do that, but not till later. What you have to do is what? You seek to do this first between you and the other person. And then if that is prevented, or if for some reason it doesn't happen, or maybe the nature of the conflict or the discomfort between you and that other person has been in place for so long that it's almost impossible for these two people to get together without there being an escalation of the problem. Then what does Jesus do? He provides a means by which this can still be reconciled, that there can still be a bridge that occurs, right? Still can happen, but it's going to take the involvement of somebody else who can help. And that's the key. Sometimes we find that we want to involve other people because we want somebody to be on our side. Right? I mean, doesn't that make sense? Yeah, if this person has wounded me in some way, I feel diminished. I feel like there's not enough of me to deal with it. So what do? I find some person that I think can bring some equality to that situation, correct? And so sometimes then what happens is people say, well, I'm going to go and look for somebody that can't stand that guy. I mean, wouldn't that be the normal, natural thing to do? Because now we are able to really crush this guy's power because all we have to do is find two of us and go up against one of us. And then what? And so when that happens, by the way, what does this guy often do? He goes and finds D, and now D and A are going up against C and B, right? And what happens is we fill in the whole alphabet with triangles. That's what we do, right? Now, does anything get resolved? Does reconciliation occur? No. All that happens is I got my team and you have your team. I have my side and you have your side. And the inevitable end of that is somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. Reconciliation doesn't occur. So see, the question is, how do we do this in such a way that we're reflective of the idea, as the Bible talks about, that we're to be ambassadors of reconciliation, if every single time we do things that subvert reconciliation instead of doing things that support reconciliation? And so that's the idea here. All right, so do you remember now what is the word yuck mean? Those of you that were here last time, you're doing your quiz now. This is your do you remember? This is the yuck pile, right? And what goes in the yuck pile?
Bad feelings.
Bad feelings can go in there. Anytime that there is an it that doesn't get addressed, acknowledged, or resolved in some way, it goes in the yuck pile. Now, I know I mentioned to you last week that it's not a very scientific term, the word yuck, but it seems to be a common word because when I mentioned it, everybody seemed to know exactly what I was talking about. But I did a little research in the Bible, and I found that there's actually a Bible verse that goes along with the word yuck. Now, the Bible is much more descriptive of yuck than I was being, but if you want to look up, let's see, those of you that have one with you, look up 2 Kings. The Old Testament is filled with references to yuck, by the way. And the prophets often used that word or a synonym of it. So somebody look up and be prepared to read out loud 2 Kings 9, verse 37. I hope I can read my own handwriting. Does somebody have that? Well, are you too embarrassed to read it? Did you find it? What does it say?
Yes, there is.
Jezreel's body will be like dung on the ground in the plot at Jezreel, so that no one will be able to say, this is Jezebel?
Yes. So what was the key word there? Dung. Does anybody not know what dung is? Okay, dung is the Bible's word for yuck. That's what it is. And so when our unresolved, unfinished, unacknowledged, unrepented sort of prideful stuff that we do that does not bring about reconciliation in some way or does not repair the hurt that we cause, it goes in the yuck pile, i.e. the Bible's word is the dung pile. And you can have whatever imagery you want of that, okay? All right, so see, that's the idea of it. And so Jesus says the yuck pile between two people is not a good thing. Because one of the things that can happen over time with the yuck pile is that it grows. And the problem is whatever goes in there doesn't just sit there in a dormant way. It ferments. And how you know it ferments is that every once in a while, it's like a little volcano. There's a little piece here that shoots out in the most unexpected moments and, frankly, unwelcome. So, example. How many of you have ever been in a conversation, either you were this person or you were this person, you were the A or the B, and you were talking about a specific it, and then all of a sudden mention is made of 20 other its that are related or not related to the original it, that is a moment when there was a slight little eruption, a little fissure occurred, and out comes a bunch of other stuff from the past that at least in one person's mind is related, but in the person's mind who's hearing it is thinking, I don't have any idea why you're bringing all that stuff up from the past, right? Because that person says, because I can't what? Change the past, right? So why would someone bring up stuff that can't be changed?
To build their case.
Yes, and the case is what a schmuck this guy is because he hasn't been attending to those things, and frankly, there is a little slight little truth to it. Okay? Yeah, Kathy.
You were listening to my conversation last night.
With Richard?
No.
Oh, sorry.
we agreed the word that we would use in the conversation when the extraneous came in that was deflection.
Deflection?
Yes, they were deflecting the real issue.
So. You can, okay, but I think that sometimes people's minds go to similarities. And the similarity would be, well, this is what happened this time, but that reminds me of what happened this time, and this time, and this time, and this time. And so when that happens, and I'll tell you a little bit about what something you can do about that, okay? But the worst thing you can do is bring it up. Because what it serves to do is deflect. It also overwhelms this person.
No, they did that to me.
Mm-hmm.
I was the B, they were the A.
Yeah, it would be the other way around. Sure, sure. And so then what happens is that it increases a bad feeling about why it was so stupid for us to think that we could talk this through. Okay, and guess what happens? Conversation stops. We don't talk it through. And more yuck is added to the now bigger yuck pile. That's a sad thing. And you see, it doesn't have to be that way. If we simply follow some of the stuff that Jesus actually said, okay, but that we're also prepared to do it, and we also have people who actually can be facilitators of that bridge, as opposed to being overwhelmed by it or feeling like that I have to be on that person's side because that person's my friend or because I work with the guy or because something bad will happen to me if I don't. And you see, that's why one of the outcomes, I hope, of our study in this is that we can identify some people who might be really skilled or be willing to become skilled and have a bit of the temperament and somewhat hard-headedness that you have to have if you're going to do this. Because it does put you in harm's way when you tell this person you love them but you're not on their side. You might not get invited to any more parties. You might get unfriended in whatever social media thing you're into. Or you might just find that whenever you see them, they're giving you mean stares. Because you're not, your interest in that moment is not to be on this person's side or that person's side, but it's to do what? It's to serve the interests of reconciliation. Okay? So that's kind of my little dream here that I'm having out of this. Okay? Yeah, Kathy.
You're addressing us as Christians. Can you use this model for when you're dealing with somebody who's not a Christian? Is that part of it?
Yep. I think you can. We'll see. Okay? So we'll look at it. If we ever get to it, we'll get to it.
Sorry.
Okay? No, that's my fault. Okay. All right. So let's go down to point A here. And this is sort of the question that I left with you last week. Is I want for you to ask yourself the question, what style of going and pointing out? See, that's what Jesus says, is if your brother sins against you or there's something between you, some it happens, okay, then he says, go and point out that to facilitate listening and winning them over. And so we all know what happens when we get upset about something and the level of upsetness goes to a high stress place. We talked about that last week, that this is the high. So I always like to use a scale of 1 to 10 because it's a little bit easier to describe what the high part of it and the low part of it is. So when people are in high stress, which would be a 7 to a 10, there's not going to be any reconciliation because everything that's going on in the brain and in the body is all about self-preservation. So the imagery would be that we're all in the water swimming around because the boat sank, and there's one life preserver, and it's a one-man life preserver, and I'm looking around, and I'm at the one-man life preserver, and I see three other people coming toward me. In that moment, what am I thinking? We cannot all get on this, so I have got to do what? Save myself. That's what's happening at high stress. Save yourself. And so I'm going to fight you off because you're a threat to my survival. It never occurs to us that there might be another option. Options occur to you when you're down here. So what do you think might be a good little thing to learn how to do is how do I get myself from high stress to moderate stress? I might have to have some little tips on how to do that. What did you say, Ann?
Breathe.
Breathe. You know, breathing is so amazing. And we mostly take it for granted. When people are up here, what happens to your breathing when you're at high stress? You're still breathing. Okay, you still are, obviously, because otherwise you would, like, die. But what's happening to your breath? Speeds up, right? And then when it speeds up, how deep does it become? It can't. It's shallow. It's like panting. Okay, it's like that. Well, what that does to your heart is it tells your heart that you're going to die because you're not getting enough air, not oxygen. So then your heart kicks in and says what? We have to beat faster. Because if we don't beat faster, then oxygen won't get where it needs to go and then we'll die. So you see all the systems inside of the body kick in because I'm at high stress. How would I know, by the way, that I'm at high stress? Because some people can fake themselves out. You say, you know, you sound upset. Do what?
When my watch is
on. Oh, you have a smartwatch. I thought you were saying, hey, Pastor Roddy, check the time here. That's see, instantly I was here, and then I went right up here when you did that, see. So now we have an it between us, Janet. Good thing we have our it cards. Okay, very good. All right. And see, now I lost my train of thought. See what happens? I went into brain freeze. Freeze, that's where I went. Okay. All right, so how would you know if you're in high stress, even if you think you're not? Check what? Your heart rate. 100 beats a minute or more, you're in high stress, even if you don't think you are. Okay? Now, some people are trained to manage themselves well and think clearly and make great decisions, even though they are in high stress. Who might those people be? Firefighters, pilots,
police.
Who else? Police, hopefully, medical, ambulance drivers.
Yeah, mothers.
Mothers. No, not mothers. Not mothers. Oh, not old men for sure. Okay. So how did those people get to where they can make good decisions in a high-stress moment? How did they get that? Were they born that way? Temperamentally, they might be, okay, but how else?
Training.
And what kind of training do they do? If they're a pilot, they jump in the what? Simulator, right? Which is a high-stress situation, right? And they're being monitored and they're being watched and all those kinds of things. Or they take a check ride on an actual airplane, right? What do firefighters do to train? They go into the fake building with real fire. Where we live over in Arlington, we're not very far from the Arlington Training Academy for firefighters. And so they have this like three-story, four-story building that's not a real building. But they've got real fire that comes in it and out of it and smoke and all that stuff, right? And that's where they train those guys. What about police? How do they learn?
They have to get maced and they have to get zapped and that kind of stuff.
That.
So they know.
Yeah, they get stunned, you know. See, the point is, if we have all of these people who realize that the only way that you can function well here is by training for it, why aren't we doing that in our relationships? Why do we just assume that in our relationship life, well, I'm Christian, Jesus loves me and I love him, I ought to be able to deal with it? No, you can't. Not without training. Not without practice. If we think to ourselves, oh, I'll do it when the time comes. No, you won't. Okay? So that's the point, really, of kind of giving this some deeper thought and thinking about it from the perspective that if I don't train for it, my natural instincts will kick in. And the natural instinct to preserve yourself is huge. It's giant. Okay? So that's why I think, Jesus really, I mean, part of it is he knew us so well. So let's look at the two options that you would have. One is, I call it high fight, flight style, which for most people turns into win, lose, right, wrong, proving something, self-preservation, etc. That would be our natural instinct in that moment. Where low fight, flight style is really reflective of Ephesians 4, 25 to 27. Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to your neighbor, for we are all members of one body. In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. The yuck pile is where the devil's foothold is the strongest. So I don't want to be adding to that. I want to be have to go back and talk about with that person some of those other it's in there, right? But I'm going to do it in a managed way, not in what I call it dumping. You can take that for any way you want, okay? The word it is so versatile. Have you noticed that? You know, it happens. There's all kinds of things you can say. So, very versatile. Yeah.
An advertisement for yoga classes. If you look at the church calendar, we have lots and lots of yoga classes, and we really focus on breathing and calmness.
Mm-hmm. See, I like that idea because training yourself for that deeper, slower breathing to kick in. So, are you familiar with muscle memory? Have you heard of that before? Yeah, muscle memory fits in real well here because the more that you practice something, what happens is that your body goes, oh, I know what we're doing, and everything chills, okay? So when people are first learning to do this, that's harder to get that going because, you know, your body's still kind of revved up, all right? So he says, in your anger, do not sin. Is it possible that what this person did caused anger in this person? So what might be some ways this person B, might actually end up sinning in their anger?
They just ice them out.
They what?
Ice number A out.
They ice them out?
Yeah.
Like, what is that, like a Louisiana term, ice them out?
Well, no. It's
freeze them.
I don't speak to you.
Okay.
I don't contact you. I don't look at you.
I am not known to you, that sort of thing. Okay, so let's talk about it. Well, let's talk about it from that point of view. Is there a difference between anger at a 9 and anger at a 5?
Yes.
What's the difference? You know, that is worth repeating because only half the class heard it. What is it?
Four,
yeah. So the difference between is in terms of how intense you are in that moment and how powerful you have on the inside. So if you're at an 8 or a 9 and you're verbal, stop talking. Now someone will say, "Oh, you're shunning me." No, I'm not. I have to cool down. I have to get myself back down to a 5 or a 4, then I can speak. Because part of what happens physiologically is that we become aggressive up here, but we can be assertive down here. Okay, that's the difference. You can get somebody's attention at a 5 or a 4. You don't have to go to an 8 or 9. But the problem is a lot of people feel like the only choice they have is to go to 8 or 9. And then you can get somebody's attention big time that way. But it does more damage than you think it does, and that's what Paul's talking about here. Yeah.
Believe it or not, my husband and I had a difference of opinion once. And
But you set him straight, didn't you? Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I tried. But we couldn't communicate, and the more angry I got, I would get so upset that I would be crying. And so then I couldn't talk and I couldn't think. Mm-hmm. And so he couldn't understand what the problem was because he's not at a 9 or 10.
Right.
He's at a 5 or 6, and he's thinking, what's our problem? So I actually shut myself off for a while and wrote out what I was upset about and what I was feeling and why I was feeling it and left it on his place at the dinner table. And then he understood.
With no dinner, right? Yeah. That was a good one.
And then he understood because he couldn't hear my words because of my presentation. And I couldn't communicate because I was too upset.
So that's a really great example of when you're at an 8 or a 9 and you're angry, or just let's say you're just like hurt and upset, the other person will not hear what you're saying. They'll only hear the 8. And the problem is that, again, and we talked about this last week, remember with the little visual I gave you of what happens with the body and then also relationally, is that it's not until you get back down to a four or five that you're going to be able to think clearly enough in order to articulate yourself. And because the level of intensity is not there, it's more likely the other person will hear you. Okay? So I like the idea, if you go to an 8 or a 9, that you do have to remove yourself. I coach that. You remove yourself. Because you're not going to be, what you're going to say and what you're going to do is not going to come out the way that you wanted it to. And then you're creating a whole bunch of other it's that now have to be addressed and repaired because of the way that you did something as opposed to the thing itself. Okay? All right, we're doing great here. All right, so we're kind of working through this idea of becoming more listenable. I have a book in my office that I bought, not because I ever wanted to read it, but I love the title. I have several of those. And here's the title of the book. It's a really great title. It's How to Talk So That Your Kids Will Listen and How to Listen So That Your Kids Will Talk. And I would argue that ain't just true about kids, right? Yeah. Isn't that great? Because what it's really looking at is the mutuality of this. See, the mutuality is that what does this person need to do in order to be heard by this person, and what does this person need to do to be open the door for this person to be able to speak? And that's the mutuality of it. That's what the whole point of Matthew 18 is that somehow we want to be supportive of each other so that we can bring healing to this. We have reconciliation, and we're not adding to the yuck pile. And maybe we could actually tackle some of the stuff that's in the history, which is in the yuck pile. Okay? So that's kind of the thinking there. Any thoughts about that so far? Yeah, Richard.
Actually, I was thinking, because of the way you described writing it out, that there's another scale with the stress scale.
Yeah.
You can call it the clarity of thought, and it's inverse. So when you're at high stress, the clarity of your thought is very low, and vice versa.
That's right, because usually when we're at high stress, we go into blame mode, and we say it's somebody else's fault that I am where I am. Okay? And it never occurs to us to turn the mirror back on ourselves and say, I wonder what I might have done to contribute to this. It does not occur to us when we're up here unless we have been trained or have been training ourselves to do that. But generally, mostly, it's down here. An example of this would be Adam and Eve in the garden. Everything was great, and then all of a sudden, here comes the devil saying, hey, you know, if you eat this fruit, your life would be way better. So they said, okay, we like to be like God. Let's do it. So what was the very first thing when God came to them there in what is their location when God says, where are you? They're hiding. So that tells you already, were they at high stress or low stress? High stress. And what else personally had they done to indicate that they were very uncomfortable with the new situation?
Covered up
with fig leaves. That tells you how stupid we become also when we're up here thinking we have a permanent solution Well, it only lasts for 2 days. Okay, so that tells you thinking is not clear when we're up here, right? Okay, so then God comes and he says, where are you? Well, now God knows, they know God knows, and they were at a 7, now they're at a 10. And so then God says to Adam, what is this you have done? And what is it that Adam does right in that moment to indicate that he is not willing to turn the mirror on himself? He tilts the mirror. He doesn't see himself anymore. He looks in the mirror and he sees her, and he sort of aims it upward and aims it at God, because the woman you gave me, she gave me of the fruit, and what else was I supposed to do, God? If I didn't eat of it, I'd hear about it forever, right? Right? And so then what'd he do? He casts the blame. See, that's what we do when we're up here. It's offensive or defensive. It's win or lose. It's live or die. And see, it's all those things. And that's what happens when we practice what we practice up there. So really, it goes to the issue is, I'm going to think better. I'm going to be able to look at myself a little bit better and say, I wonder what I might have done that added to this, something like that. But I'm only going to be able to do that down here at a 6 or below. Okay? Does that make sense? Yeah. Aren't we having fun? All right, well, let's look at page 7. What factors could contribute to listening? We've kind of talked about what gets in the way of listening, but let's talk about what contributes to it. Colossians 3:12, therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. The key phrase there is holy and dearly loved. See, part of it is that we have to remember that we're loved. That's what we have to remember. And that how we know we're loved is because God sent Christ to be our Savior. That's how we know we're loved. Well, see, if I forget that, or I'm not focusing on the love part, then I'm thinking the only recourse I have is to get you before you get me. Right?
Yep. Yeah.
James 1:19, dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. Boy, that nails us, doesn't it? Right? See, quick to listen. So we're going to be talking about listening. And then this one I love, Proverbs 18:13, to answer before listening, that is folly and shame. And a lot of us are in the habit of listening only halfway. We listen until we think we've heard what the thing is. And then we stop listening, and while the other person's still talking, we're formulating our defense, and particularly how they're wrong, right? And that's what we do. So the idea is to think, to give yourself an opportunity, and the way you do that is think of that scale 1 to 10, and then you drop it and do the breathing, do all that stuff, remove yourself from the situation, and that's how you do it. Yeah, Debbie.
A great erupter.
Okay.
And you taught Mark and I how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, it's, you know, never going to work, but whatever.
That's what you thought. I was teaching you that, and you thought it will never work. Okay.
Well, consider.
Okay.
So, the thing is, and one day, Mark was talking, and he's going on, and I'm like, but I want to get in my thought. I want to say what I want to say. So I thought he had gone on long enough. I popped up and said something, and you looked at me, and with all seriousness and whatever,
yeah,
and said to me,
what did I say?
Did you really need to say that right now?
Oh.
And I thought, and that has stuck in my head.
Hmm.
Stuck in my head.
Okay.
Because before now, if we are in a discussion of something, number one, I know to close my mouth sooner than later. But it works.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we can approach each other. And we may need that space for a little bit.
Yeah.
But it does work.
That's good.
So it did work.
I feel quite proud of myself. Yeah, somebody else had their hand up. Oh, yeah.
when I was in the corporate world, one of the exercises we did as a group in our department, as a listening skill, someone would say something to us, and then we would repeat back what we thought we heard from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was, like, I didn't use the sense, but, I mean, we thought it was a good exercise.
I put that in here. Okay, so it's called kind of reflective, yep. Reflective listening a little bit, which I think, again, it's very hard to do reflective listening when you're up here or the other person is. But here's what I've learned, is that if the other person is at the 7 to 10 and you do reflective listening, you're going to bring everybody's intensity level down. Now, yours might not go down because it takes some work to do that. But actually, you can be someone who facilitates a lowering of the intensity level in the moment if you do reflective listening. And we'll talk about what that is. I included that in here, okay? Because, see, what happens is when it occurs and somebody feels hurt or offended, okay, in that moment, how it's handled has the potential of either escalating it or de-escalating it. It's kind of an either or in that moment, okay? So if I can do some things that actually demonstrate that I value you. Now, I don't have to agree with you, and I probably don't, but I'm valuing you in that moment. I'm listening. I'm demonstrating that I actually heard you. I'm not looking for the errors in what you said and trying to, you know, correct the little sequence of how you saw it versus how I saw it. I'm not doing any of that. Okay, I'm just listening and reflecting back what you said in kind of a paraphrase form. What will happen is the intensity and the steam in this person will be reduced. Does that fix everything? No, it does not fix everything. But what it does is it sets the foundation in place for us to be able to address the thing. Okay, and that's the key here. Is that you have to think in terms of there is a bit of a step sequence here that you have to do. And if you derail it, then it isn't going to happen, or it just postpones it or adds to the yuck pile, which is something none of us wants. Okay? All right, so what Jesus says is that if the person doesn't listen, then what do? Is you take along two or three others. And here's kind of where I would say that the natural instinct for the person B is to go find somebody that is on their side, but that has to be resisted. So even if that person does that, we have to say to that person, no, that's not how we're going to do that. The way we're going to do it is we're going to offer to you somebody who knows how to help bring about this. That's what we're going to do. That's how we're going to do it. And so then that the two or three others that could become a part of that are people that know what they're doing. They're people that are able to keep themselves relatively calm in a stressful situation, which entering into that dispute between those two people is very stressful. That's why it's not built for everybody. Okay? But if we had that or have access to that, then that's what we can offer. So one of the things we want to be aware of is that sometimes there are different roles that people play when they get involved in some it between other people, okay? It's not always because they're busybodies. One way that people will sometimes get involved is in a rescuing form. So they step in to eliminate the disagreement and to protect those that are wounded by it. And very often, it's a one-time intervention to save somebody. Like if somebody was being a victim of abuse or something where there's a criminal thing involved and you have got to step in and get those parties in a safe place, that's kind of what the rescuer does, okay? So that's one role. Another role is an advocate, where an advocate will often side with whoever is perceived as the victim. So usually it's whoever was the one that the it was done to will instinctively feel like a victim. And one of the things that's kind of happened in our society today is that there's a lot of people who are victims, and then there are a lot of people who say that they're victims, and it's hard to tell the difference between the two. But what happens with advocates is that they will very often speak for the person that cannot speak for himself. They fight for those that can't fight for themselves, and that can be an ongoing thing. The problem for an advocate very often is that advocate people often have experienced the same thing in their own life that they are now advocating for in their later life. And when that happens, sometimes their own personal yuck pile gets in the way of the bigger yuck pile that they're trying to attend to. And so that can sometimes happen too. It's sort of like saying, I'm angry because so-and-so did that to you, and I'm also angry because the same thing happened to me. Okay, now if that's the case, then you're going to be an advocate, then what you have to make sure you do is keep the it separate. And very often that takes the help of a professional to help you do that. And then a facilitator is somebody that objectively guides the process of working through the disagreement, teaching people the process so that eventually they can do it on their own. And that person is not on anybody's side, except the side of that we are, once again, a we. So see, that's the difference between it. And if you get that confused, then the role that you're playing can either help or get in the way of the reconciliation you're hoping to bring about. Okay, so let's get into the actual process. So the actual process is broken up into three phases, and we'll talk about the first one today, and then next week we will hit the other two that kind of go together. All right, so the first phase is called listening for mutual respect and understanding. All right, and so here's what we're going to do to illustrate this. Let's talk about what this person here, person B, who is the offended person or the hurt person or the one who has been sinned against, so to speak, what is that person supposed to do in preparation for reaching out to person A? Is okay if we look at it that way? Okay. So the first thing that you want to do is calm yourself prior to requesting a visit with the other person. So you might have to do that breathing. You might have to do some of that stuff. Why is that? If you reach out to that other person and you're at an 8 or a 9, what is likely to occur as a result of your 8 or your 9?
It'll make matters worse.
The wall goes up.
Yeah.
So there's a guy by the name of John Gottman. He's kind of one of my guys that I read a lot of his stuff. He's a marriage researcher up in Washington State at University of Washington. He's done a lot of research on this. And he talks about what's called a soft startup versus a harsh startup. In other words, if you come at somebody in an aggressive way, 86% of the time, that predicts a poor outcome of the conversation. Because you're going to be in attack mode. You're going to be in blame mode. And even if you're not with your words, the tone of voice that you use will tell the other person, be on guard, be on guard. So it's kind of thinking about it that way. Yeah.
I learned about modeling calm behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And how that, when you model that calm behavior, like sometimes I have to say to myself when dealing with, say, a younger person that lives
yes.
in my home.
Yes.
I would say, who is the role model here, and am I going to model calm, or am I going to model that?
Yeah.
Because if I model that's how they're going to come back at me.
Some of us are more expressive when we are at a 9, and others of us are calmer in the way that we kind of roll. The calmer person has to be careful that you don't come across menacing. Mm-hmm. Like the calm before the storm, okay? So again, see, you can be a very calm person and sort of more internal, right? Whereas other people are more, you know, like this, right? And either one of them still says that I can be at the 8 and I need to get myself down to a 5 before I request. Now, the other part of it is that, generally speaking, the more upset someone is, the more likely they are to demand a sitting with the other person than they are to request it. And part of the reason for that is Think how long person B has been living with this annoyance or this thing that bugs them or this thing that hurt them. And because person A didn't even know that they did or caused that, the person A is just kind of going through, hey, this is great, this is great. And person B is miserable. So very often that causes person B to demand, we need to meet right now. And I can see, I know you're very busy right now watching reruns of Super Bowl IX. I can see that you are, right? And so part of that is that if you calm yourself down, you make more room for the other person to actually say, okay, I want to meet with you. Okay, so the second thing is process the it on paper. Now, somebody mentioned writing it out. Excellent. If you didn't want to write it out because you're like a person of few words, then you can use an it card. So an it card is just another way to do it. I mean, some people like to write, you know, a novel, and that's okay. But what an it card actually does is it helps you boil down what's the it and how's it making you feel. And if you look on the back of the card, did my reaction to the it create a bigger problem? And then, oh, ideas that I have to problem solve the it. But notice what the first thing is on the it card. What's it say? One trait that I cannot stand about that person, and that's why I want to do this, right? Is that what it says? What does it say? One trait I appreciate. Why would I include that in there? Because thinking about that, see, oftentimes when a person does an it, the only thing we can think of is how crummy that person is. And if I'm thinking about how crummy that person is, I take that attitude with me into the conversation. So I need to remember that there's some redeemable things about that person. That person is likely holy and beloved just like I am. You know? That person's likely to have some very positive traits just like I am. And so it helps keep perspective or bring perspective that maybe you wouldn't have. And it also helps you do it down here rather than being up here when you have the conversation. And so the idea of the it card or whatever tool that you want to use is that you're looking for any possible planks in your own eye. And we know kind of that reference in Matthew 7. You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye in order to remove the speck in the brother's eye. Notice something. There is an obligation to remove the speck in the brother's eye. That's pretty offensive in our society today. Because in our society today, people say, hey, mind your own business. And so there is something to be said for what is that responsibility we have to each other. Thirdly, determine if you can overlook or forgive the it without a meeting. Is it possible that you could forgive that person from your heart and not really need to meet with them? So what might be one reason that you might need to go ahead and meet with them after you forgave them?
Because you don't want them to do it again.
Yeah. So because there might be some problem solving we need to do together to say, let's figure out a different way to do this. Okay? And so that's where you would need to have a meeting. So you contact the other person, you request, not demand, a time to meet. Generally, what I found is that when things are too rough between these people, and then I'm asked to be the C person, then I'm the one that sets up the meeting. So sometimes person C has to be the one, but then that would have been agreed upon by everybody. Okay? Prepare yourself spiritually, praying for God's peace to govern your tone. Remember the Yahweh prayer a long time ago? We talked about that. I could probably mention that again next time. In terms of a way to quiet yourself. You calm yourself, you thank the other person for being willing to meet, you calmly state the it, which you have spelled out on your it card. By the way, the it card is not a suggestion card. Don't fill it out and slip it under the pillow of the other person or the door, like the pastor's door. I don't want a bunch of it cards under my door after class today. And here's the trick to this. If you're the one that's talking about the it, limit yourself to talking about it for only 1 minute. Because if you want the other person to actually hear you and be able to reflect back what they hear, you have to put yourself on the clock. If you're listening to a person who's telling you about your imperfections. And they're going on and on and on. At some point, their brain cannot absorb any more bad news about who they are and what they've done. So you have to put yourself on the clock. But you do that so that this can be a conversation, not a monologue. And see, that's part of the reason why if I'm down here at a five, it's way more easy for me to do that. If I'm up at an eight or so, not only am I filling the room with lots of words, but I'm talking really fast. And it's just hard to absorb all that, right, Brian? It's very hard, yeah. So that is part of what the respectful speaking has to do to bring about a good conclusion as well as respectful listening. Okay, we are at the end of our time. Is this okay that we're doing this? It's very practical. Okay, it's good stuff. And we will sort of finish this next time. Then we get into the next two parts. And then on February, whatever that date is, we'll start the book of Revelation. And we'll work through the whole book in 1 week. And then we'll be done with it. It'll be awesome, right? It'll be the fastest 60 minutes ever, right? Yes, I know. My track record is not that great at even getting done with two verses in 1 week. Okay, let's close our prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for our time together, and thank you for the opportunity that we have to learn about some different ways to work with each other and to bring some reconciliation in our own lives and then be instrumental in bringing reconciliation to the lives of other people. The world is in desperate need of that, dear Lord, and we are, as Christians, wonderfully positioned to be able to offer it. But Lord, frankly, we also get caught up in it, and then we need others to help us as well. So open our hearts and minds to what we're talking about this month, and help us to keep that in our minds and to use that to bring about or to be a bridge for other people. So watch over us this week until we're together again, and we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Messiah's Upper Room. Here at Messiah Lutheran Church, our mission statement is sharing His light. That means sharing the light that is Jesus Christ and telling others about His gospel. If you want to join us in that mission, please share this podcast with someone that may want to come and better know the light of Jesus. Use one of our past episodes as a starting point to start a discussion with someone, or use a past series as a personal Bible study or devotional for your family or small group. If we've given any value to you at all, consider leaving this podcast a rating and review on iTunes. That will help us climb the iTunes rankings so we may better spread the reassuring good news of Jesus Christ and continue to share His light with anyone willing to listen. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, may God bless you throughout your week. Bye.